Hello, and welcome to Learning English, the daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America in Washington. This program is designed to help people like you learn everyday American English. Every day of the year, we bring you reports about what is happening in the United States and around the world. In our reports, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words and expressions that are easy to understand. On Sundays, we tell you about what is happening in education. We also bring you new American English expressions. And we present The Making of a Nation, a series that tells the history of the United States. If you listen to this program, you will learn about the United States and the world. And if you practice saying the words and sentences the way we do, you will quickly improve your American English skills. This is what you will hear on today's program. In our weekly higher education report, correspondent Pete Musto will tell us how online degree programs are changing education. Then you will hear Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs. This week, Anna Mateo will tell us about some of the many American English expressions using the word farm. And finally, as we do every Sunday, we will present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, we continue the story of America's 42nd president, Bill Clinton. Now, here is higher education correspondent Pete Musto with his report on how online degree programs are changing education.
The more than 4,000 colleges and universities in the United States offer many different educational experiences. For hundreds of years, young people have come to these schools to learn new things and find direction in life. But now, with the help of technology, the way knowledge passes from teachers to their students is changing. In February 2016, the Babson Survey Research Group reported that 28% of all U.S. college students took at least one class over the internet. The research group, part of Babson College in Massachusetts, studies all levels of education across the country. Yet having students take a few online classes during their college years is not the only change technology is driving. Many U.S. colleges and universities now offer full degree programs online. This opens up all kinds of possibilities for students around the world. One such student, Leanne from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, is using an online degree program to meet her needs. The 30-year-old asked VOA not to share her last name as she has yet to complete her studies. In 2012, Leanne earned a bachelor's degree in nursing through a traditional study program at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. She then started working as a nurse in the Washington, D.C. area. After a few years, Leanne decided she wanted to earn a master's degree to help further her career in medicine. However, she did not want to move to another city to continue her education, as can often be the case for students. Her job and her husband were in Washington, and she only wanted to study part-time. So, Leanne decided to look for an online program.
There were a lot of appealing things about doing it online. It allowed me to work full-time and fit the schoolwork into my schedule, which also made it a lot more financially feasible. And the nurse practitioner programs, they have nationally gone towards being online to the point where it's actually very difficult to find a program that was in person.
In 2014, Leanne began taking nursing classes through the online master's degree program at DC's George Washington University. The program provides medical training videos through her home computer. She also is involved in discussion groups, takes tests, and submits projects online. Leanne says much of her studies are self-directed. But students also must physically visit the university at least 4 times during their 3-year program for in-person testing. Leanne says her program appeals to a lot of people with full-time jobs. And George Washington University is not alone in its efforts to spread online education. The communications company AT&T gave the Georgia Institute of Technology $4 million to create an online degree program in 2014. This led to an online master's degree program in computer science. And in the past few years, the program has become a true success story, says Joshua Goodman, an associate professor of public policy at Harvard University. Goodman says online degree programs have faced 2 major barriers. First, it has often been lesser known, lower quality, or for-profit universities that have offered online programs. Second, well-known, high-quality schools charged the same price for online and in-person programs. This often led to students choosing the traditional programs. But the Georgia Tech program may have solved these problems, Goodman says. Many experts consider the university to have one of the best computer science master's degree programs in the country. Also, Georgia Tech began offering the online program at less than 1/6 of the cost of the traditional program. The school's in-person program only has room for about 300 students. The online program had about 1,700 new students at the start of the school year. Goodman argues it is not just the quality or the price that make Georgia Tech's online program so successful. The average age of students trying to get into the traditional program is about 24. The average age of the online students is 34. These are people in the middle of their careers, Goodman notes. They are not free to drop everything and spend a few years studying instead of working.
The folks who applied for this program did not have other educational options that they would do if they didn't get into this program. What we found is that if they got into this program, they went, they did this degree, and if they didn't get in, almost none of them went to another university. So it seems like this program is creating educational opportunities for mid-career people that would not have otherwise existed.
Online degree programs seem to not only help students with non-traditional needs. In some cases, the appeal of the programs has helped the schools themselves. This is especially important considering many colleges and universities have struggled financially in recent years. Simmons College is a small private college in Boston, Massachusetts. For several years, Simmons accepted more graduate students than undergraduates. In 2010, the school created a plan to start offering two of its most popular master's degree programs online. The two are in nursing and social work. Last year, the college collected about $45 million in student payments for those programs. This year, the programs are expected to bring in about $55.9 million. This is about $3 million more than all the in-person graduate programs Simmons offers combined. Suzanne Murphy is the head of the online programs at Simmons. She says the reason those programs appeal to so many students is the quality. You measure success in student outcomes, Murphy said. How are the students doing? How are they progressing through the programs? Things like that. And the programs that we put online are the same programs that we have on the ground. Leanne, Goodman, and Murphy all agree there are many other ways to improve online degree programs in general. Next week, we will look at some of the problems such programs still face. I'm Pete Musto.
Thanks, Pete. Now, here is Anna Mateo to explain some of the American English expressions using the word farm.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. Today, we are down on the farm. Since the 16th century, the word farm has meant land used for agricultural purposes. But a much older meaning is related to economics. The English word farm comes from the Latin word firma, which means an unchanging payment. Experts say the earliest meaning of farm was a yearly payment made on a loan, or as a tax. Centuries ago, English farmers did not own their land. They made payments to the owner for the right to grow crops. Okay, so the word farm has roots in economics. Therefore, it's no surprise to hear about someone buying a farm. That is very different from someone who has bought the farm. When someone tells you that someone bought the farm, do not offer your congratulations. Bought the farm is a lighthearted way to say that a person has died. Now, buying the farm is very different from betting the farm. When you bet the farm, you are willing to risk everything because you are confident in something. Used in conversation, it may sound like this. Jack was out really late last night. I'm willing to bet the farm that today he will be late for work. So you can buy, own, or bet a farm. You can also just farm, as in the verb. But today the verb farm has come to mean something more than raising crops. To farm something out means to give work or duties to someone else to finish. This farming action is quite different from planting and raising crops. To do that, farmers plant seeds. You could say that seeds start the growth process. In business, seed money is the financing you need to launch a project or company. Now, sometimes we call the act of raising crops sowing crops. To sow means to plant seeds in the ground. The verb sow also means to set in motion or to cause something to exist, especially things such as fear, doubt, or suspicion. If your friend continues to act foolishly, you could plant a seed of caution in him. To plant a seed in someone is to influence another person's thinking or behavior. And as we just heard, you can plant a seed of something. Americans often use the expression to plant a seed of doubt. If that seed, whether of doubt, caution, or some other idea, takes root, it begins to develop into something bigger. If it dies on the vine, it doesn't grow into anything worth keeping, just something else to clean up. We can also say that a plant, person, or idea has gone to seed. To go to seed is to worsen in condition because of lack of care. This expression is based on the actual meaning of plants that go to seed. They stop producing flowers and start producing seeds. And that brings us to the end of Words and Their Stories. Hopefully, some of these farm expressions will take root in your everyday English. I'm Ana Mateo.
Thanks, Anna. Now we present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, Steve Ember continues the story of America's 42nd president, Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton took office in January of 1993. During his 8 years as president, he appointed more women and minorities to the government than any president before him. He also appointed the second woman ever to serve on the Supreme Court. For the first 2 years of his presidency, Bill Clinton had a Congress controlled by members of his own party, the Democrats. Still, he failed in his efforts to pass legislation to reform the nation's health care system. During the presidential campaign, Bill Clinton had promised to help millions of Americans get health care coverage.
This health care system of ours is badly broken, and it is time to fix it. Despite the dedication of literally millions of talented health care professionals, our health care is too uncertain and too expensive, too bureaucratic and too wasteful. It has too much fraud and too much greed. We must make this our most urgent priority. Giving every American health security, health care that can never be taken away, health care that is always there.
He appointed his wife, First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton, to lead a committee to develop the plan. Critics argued that the plan would lead to socialized medicine. In the end, lawmakers decided that the plan would cost too much and would be too difficult to administer. But President Clinton found support on other issues, including crime-fighting legislation. The measure included money for hiring more police officers and building more prisons. Congress also passed his budgets for 1993 and 94 that reduced federal spending. But Clinton's relations with Congress became more difficult after the 1994 congressional elections. The fight over health care and other issues had only led to greater dissatisfaction with Washington. CNN reporter Frank Cessno. Voters gave Republicans control of both the Senate and the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years. Budget fights with the Republican-led Congress resulted in two shutdowns of government operations.
It is particularly unfortunate that the Republican Congress has brought us to this juncture because, after all, we share a central goal, balancing the federal budget. We must lift the burden of debt that threatens the future of our children and grandchildren. Unfortunately, Republican leaders in Washington have put ideology ahead of common sense and shared values.
The economy had suffered a recession during the previous administration of George H.W. Bush. After Bill Clinton became president, the economy grew slowly at first, but then recovered more quickly. 1 month into his presidency, Bill Clinton had to deal with a terrorist attack against the United States.
There's been an explosion deep below the 110-story towers of the World Trade Center in New York City.
On February 26, 1993, members of Al-Qaeda attacked the World Trade Center in New York City. The terrorists left a truck loaded with explosives in an underground parking garage.
By early afternoon, Lower Manhattan looked like a war zone. Office workers, faces blackened with smoke and soot, hundreds gasping for breath, staggered into the frigid February air.
The attack killed six people and injured more than 1,000 others. The government later captured those responsible for the bombing. On April 19, 1995, terrorists again struck the United States. Only this time, it was a case of homegrown terrorism. The target was the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
It was an explosion blowing off the entire north face of that building.
The bombing killed 168 people. It was the deadliest terrorist attack ever on American soil up to that time. The man behind the attack was Timothy McVeigh, a former soldier who hated the government. He was captured soon after the explosion. McVeigh was tried and in 2001 executed for his crimes. A friend of his, another military veteran, was also involved in the plot and was sent to prison. President Clinton also had to deal with foreign and humanitarian crises.
A year ago, we all watched with horror as Somali children and their families lay dying by the tens of thousands, dying the slow, agonizing death of starvation. A starvation brought on not only by drought, but also by the anarchy that then prevailed in that country.
President Bush had sent American troops to Somalia in 1992 to assist the United Nations in feeding starving Somalis. Civil war was preventing the people from receiving aid during a drought. In October of 1993, 18 American soldiers were killed in a battle in Mogadishu. It happened during a failed raid on a hotel to search for a militia leader. But members of Congress demanded a withdrawal. A few days after the battle, President Clinton ordered American troops to leave Somalia within 6 months. In 1994, President Clinton sent troops to Haiti to return that country's first democratically elected leader to office. Military officers had overthrown President Jean-Bertrand Aristide 3 years earlier. That crisis led thousands of Haitian refugees to try to flee to the United States by boat. In 1995, American diplomatic efforts, as well as NATO airstrikes, helped produce a peace agreement to end the long and bloody civil war in Bosnia. President Clinton sent American peacekeeping troops to the former Yugoslav Republic. In November of 1993, Congress approved NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. The agreement ended most import taxes between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. It lowered barriers to the flow of goods, services, and investments. President Bush had signed the agreement with Mexico and Canada. American labor unions and environmental groups opposed NAFTA, but Congress approved it, and President Clinton signed it into law.
Personal issues from Bill Clinton's past in Arkansas became part of his future as President of the United States. In the late 1970s, he and Hillary Clinton had invested in a land development company in Arkansas called Whitewater. In January 1994, after a year as president, Bill Clinton asked Attorney General Janet Reno to appoint an independent investigator. The Attorney General named a Republican, Robert Fisk, to look into the activities of the Clintons. But critics accused him of being too friendly to the administration. In August, three federal judges replaced him with another Republican lawyer, Kenneth Starr. Public opinion was divided about the situation. Some people thought the president and his wife were corrupt. Others thought any accusations of wrongdoing were nothing more than political attacks. Bill Clinton went on to win a second term in the elections in November 1996. But new issues about his personal behavior would lead Republicans to try to remove him from office. Clinton's second term will be our story next Sunday here on Learning English. This Making of a Nation program was written by David Jarmul, Steve Ember, and Geraldine Watson. It was presented and produced by Steve Ember. And we thank them all. For all of us here at VOA Learning English in Washington, thanks for spending some time with us today. I hope you'll join us tomorrow for another Learning English program from the Voice of America.